You're listening to Guildcast, the podcast about that video game Guild Wars, and the sequel also, which is Guild Wars 2. Oh, that figures, Bobby.
You're listening to Guildcast. It's a podcast about Guild Wars and Guild Wars 2.
Hey, yeah, you're listening to Guildcast. It's a podcast all about Guild Wars and Guild Wars 2.
Did you ever lose your car keys? Do the words Guild Cast mean anything to you by chance, Goldfinger?
Hey, baby. This is Relics of Awe and Guild Cast crossing imaginations, baby. Yeah.
Welcome back, everyone, to this ninth episode of Guildcast. I'm your host, Sean, and with me, at my side, once again, is Ruby.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good. I'm tired. This has been an insane week.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I can tell right now we're going to have a really long show this time. And, you know, there's so much information has come out, so much news. Plus, of course, we promised a very special surprise, which we have. Actually, we have more than I originally anticipated, so it's an even better surprise than before.
Woo!
And we're probably not going to read any. Well, we're definitely not going to read any email this time, only because we have 28 in the queue to be read. So what we're probably going to do is do an email show sometime after this one, and just kind of catch up on stuff. So
that's going to be good. I'm kind of excited about that, but. Yeah, there's definitely not time for it this week because ArenaNet unloaded like a truckload of information on us.
Yeah. Oh boy. We have, okay, so we have the Ranger, right?
And, yes.
And you called it.
I totally called it, but I did not get the gift certificate.
No, you didn't because you are ineligible as an employee of Guildcast.
All right, then I'll take a paycheck.
but actually Klaus, who, he's the one who won. Klaus is from Germany. And he was the very first one to comment and say, actually, it was the first comment on the post where we said comment here to tell us what, you know, for the, I guess I should probably explain a little bit. We had the contest a couple shows ago where we said, whoever's the first person to name the next profession announced in the comments wins $25 from us for Amazon.com. And Klaus was the first comment and he said Ranger. And so he got the $25. Actually, it was funny because since he's in Germany, I sent him 20 euro, which is equivalent. I think in the conversion, it's like 25.66 or something. So it's like really, really close. It's pretty amazing. So yeah, I mean, congratulations, Klaus. That was, it was a good guess because I think that, well, like you said, it was pretty obvious, but a lot of people thought because of the book that Necromancer was going to be next. And I'm one of those who saying that.
You know, I was actually a little bit surprised.
Yeah. And well, and plus I would have loved to see Mesmer too, but.
Yeah.
But what's funny about that is we actually have some news about that.
I know. This is cool.
We'll talk about that later though, because we want to cover, in this episode, we want to cover the Ranger, all the information we have on that, including interviews, little ones here and there that have been done that kind of reveal, you know, a little additional information that we don't get on the blog. Plus, there's the Ghosts of Ascalon book that is coming out on July 27th, and I was actually able to get a advanced copy of it, and I didn't eat or sleep until I was done with that book. And it's an amazing book, and that was actually going to be our surprise. I was going to say, you know, we have the book and we can talk about it. The part where we're going to talk about it is going to be spoilerific. So I'm going to give a little bit of a disclaimer before and kind of let you know the exact time periods you can skip if you don't want to hear that part. So just a warning on that we will tell you, okay, I'll actually have to record that part later and add it in where, you know, where the exact time periods.
Yeah.
So that will be spoilerific. And then the big surprise is we have an interview with Jeff Grubb, who is one of the co-authors on Ghosts of Ascalon. And we did an interview. Actually, it was for Massively. And we asked him, hey, can we go ahead and record the interview and then play it on Guildcast as well? And they said, yeah, that's fine. So we're very excited about that. Of course,
he was great.
Yeah, he was really great, answering all of our questions and, you know, just being a good sport about all that. So that was cool. Plus, of course, we have the regular Warren Crida news and all of that.
Yeah. Lots of stuff.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and get started then. The Ranger. Now, I know we have a lot of fans out there who love the Ranger. You know, it's a great class. It's one of those classes that I love to play in a lot of other games. Because I'm a big fan of ranged attack, and I'm a huge, huge fan of pet classes. So it's one that, you know, throughout all games, I usually always play that type of character, no matter if it's called Ranger or Hunter or whatever it's called. I'm a big fan of the Ranger in Guild Wars, of course. But this one seems to be, it's like the Guild Wars 1 Ranger plus a whole lot more. You know, we have a lot of the same stuff that we have in Guild Wars 1. We have the traps, the nature spirits, the ranged attack, and we have, of course, pets. But a lot of these have been expanded upon. As far as, like, pets, I think would be a good example to start with. In Guild Wars 2, there are going to be, the pets are going to be a lot more controllable. There's going to be, like, 12 different types.
Now, the cool thing about that, with the 12 different types, there are, like, subspecies within those 12 types, so there's even more.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the examples they gave was like a brown bear and a polar bear kind of fall under the bear category, you know.
Right. So,
and that's something they kind of do now. And, you know, when the Guild Wars 1 first came out, it didn't have all the pets it has now. It's expanded to include a lot more. So I'm sure they're going to expand it from there. You know, it's just one of those things that they seem to be pretty good at. But the thing is, you can have three pets, but you can only take one out at a time, you know, have one active at a time, and you can't switch between them in combat, but you can everywhere else. So, you can have, you know, you can have your, like, support pet, you can have your tanking pet, and you can have the different situational pets, and each of these pets have their own, like, you know, skill bar, I guess you could say, where it's things that they can do, like attack, heal, you know, defend, kind of a lot of the basic controls you have in pet classes. And then plus they're also going to have these ability slots, which it says when you start out, even when your pet is level one, what do they call it? Evolution level one, it's going to have all of those skills are going to be available, but you can't slot more than one. And you will have to actually open up the ability to slot those skills, right?
Yeah, you can go up to four. Now I want to go back just for a second. There is a utility skill that allows you to switch pets in combat, and you can just do it really quickly, but it's got, and we didn't get times or anything, but that was something I asked about. It actually has a huge cooldown, so you're not just, you know, bam, 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 damage, tank, support, but you can do it every now and again.
Yeah, and he made sure to say that that's a really powerful ability to be able to just switch pets like that.
So it has an equivalent cooldown.
Yeah, and is that to bring out an additional pet or to switch them?
No, that's to switch. You can only have one active at a time. But what's so cool about that is that if you've got your tank pet and something gets past it and comes at you, that's a good time. You can bust out that utility skill and switch to damage quickly. Mm-hmm. Kind of reposition your strategy as needed.
Yeah. And it's also important to note that you can buff your pets, too. And, like, they even mentioned Heal as One, which, of course, is now in Guild Wars 1, but it's something that you can use to buff your pet. And I think, from what I read, I mean, he didn't say specifically, but it sounds like there are additional ones, too, right?
Yeah, it sounds like there's more than one. I guess there's a pool you can choose from, like many of the other skills.
And I think one of the important distinctions about pets, though, is, and this was actually asked in a PC Gamer article, it's about, you know, how do you, like, can you play the Ranger still without a pet? I actually have a friend who loves the Ranger but hates pets. And I have another friend who hates rangers and pets. Even if even if they're in the group with other rangers, they hate pets so much. They won't heal pets, right? So I think that a lot of times people can't always associate pets and rangers together when they want to play a ranger. They want to play a ranged character, but they don't want to have that pet. Well, they specifically say if you are in that category, then you're not going to want to play a ranger. You're going to want to play another class because everyone has their own ranged attacks. So if you want to be a ranged attacker, but you don't, you know, you don't want some of the things that rangers have, then you can just go ahead and be a warrior or, you know, with a rifle. But the reason for this is because pets really play such an important role in the ranger. They say that, of course, you can play without a pet, but it's like, it's just like cutting the ranger in half. You know, you can't, that's so much a part of the ranger and what they do. So they're very important to the ranger. I would say much more important than the Guild Wars 1 ranger, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. They've really, really beefed up the whole pet aspect of the ranger and made it crucial.
I'm excited about the ability to control the pets and kind of send them out. I mean, right now we have that control to make them attack, but it's not like in a little skill bar like it, you know, like we see in so many other games, you know, where there's you can actually set them for like passive and aggressive defense. Not passive aggressive. That's not a stance.
Then it just sits quietly and mopes.
Yeah, and it makes little comments. Oh, I would have done that, but no, that's fine.
Whatever, I didn't think you wanted me to. You know, I guess if you want to die, that's okay.
That's fine. No, no, really, it's fine. Go ahead.
People in ArenaNet right now are going, we hate you.
Hey, ArenaNet, can you put in the passive aggressive stance, please?
Sean and I think, would play that all the time. We just run around and use our pets to make people feel bad.
Oh, I see you have the sword. Oh, that's fine. No, that one? Yeah.
No, that's fine. That's not what I would use, but I would have, you're the boss.
I would have used a different one, but no, it's fine, really.
Yeah, I hope, you know, just let me know. I'll be over here if you need anything. We're so mean.
I know.
But as far as controlling the pets, I really do love that. And I know this is something I said to you earlier. It's almost like they're little heroes.
Yeah, it is, really. Except you can't put little armor on them, right? Or we don't know yet, actually.
You know, the trailer... Don't jump the gun on that, because the trailer showed this MOA with some pretty awesome...
Oh, that's right. Wow.
Yeah, it was so cool. I loved it. Oh, but no, the fact that... And this is something I know that people that play Rangers have said so many times. Wouldn't it be great if your pet could have a skill bar and I wouldn't have to take up half of my own skill bar with all this?
Mm-hmm.
And we've got that now. You can set them to... What, heal, attack, or stay?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say passive aggressive. But you can set them to that. You can just mold them so much more. And they're probably a little smarter than Koss. So it's kind of a bonus.
Yeah, I hope they are. That would be great. And I think it's important to note, too, that when you charm them, it's a lot like kind of the whole evolution process is kind of like it is now, except it's much more advanced. Like, you know, you start out with, you have to look for a juvenile of that type of animal. Like, it's literally labeled juvenile bear or whatever. And then it says that there's an indication when you go near it that you can charm it. And then when you charm it, it becomes your pet and you have to level it. Actually, doesn't it say that it stays your level? Like, they always maintain your same level?
You know, that's actually something that I've read around, and I'm a little fuzzy on that.
Yeah.
It says the evolutions are dependent on your level and XP, but you're still starting with a juvenile one.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure. I think it's just as you gain XP and as you level, it benefits from that as well.
Yeah.
So that's the most, I don't think we have a ton of details on that quite yet.
Yeah.
But well, one thing, the overall how it works.
Yeah, I wonder, because, you know, once you're like level whatever, 20, and then you get a juvenile pet, you charm a new one, will it automatically be level 20? Yeah, I guess. And or maybe the evolution process is different as far as kind of like we have now with Dire and things like that, where the juvenile part is separate from the actual level itself.
I need to know this.
Yeah, we need to ask about that.
Okay.
I'm sure, usually when we ask questions like this, we get some great comments or great email too. People write in and tell us. So,
and if not, I have to do another Ranger interview anyway because I forgot to ask about interrupts in the last one.
Yeah, it's funny. They don't mention interrupts at all.
And I think everybody's kind of worried about that.
Yeah, because that's a huge part. That's a really fun part of Guild Wars in general. You know, the Mesmer interrupts and the Ranger interrupts. It's one of those things that where you can, you know, the speed of responsiveness in combat is something you don't find in a lot of other games like that, where they wouldn't be able to have interrupts. So, yeah, I'm really interested.
Okay, I need to. And you know what? That actually brings to mind, it's just kind of a similar thing. Something that people did notice was that the bows have strings now.
Oh, yeah.
I don't really play a ranger too much, so it's not something that I really noticed. But I think this is going to kind of, I'm going to want to play a ranger in Guild Wars 2.
See? They're teasing us here. They're getting us, they want us to play every single class.
They're probably going to sell character slots, and I'm going to be lining up to buy more.
Oh man, yeah. I have to agree though. You know, I mean, every time we do one of these, I'm always like, "Yep, that's what I'm gonna make. I'm gonna make one of those next." And yep, I'm gonna do that. And like, you know, the races and the classes. Mm-hmm. I think I should just go ahead and make a giant list of my top or the in order of the classes I like because I've said, you know, Mesmer, Necro, Paragon, even like up there, Ranger definitely. I even like the assassin. That would be up there too. Even though I make fun of it all the time.
Well, the combination, I think bringing racial abilities into the equation, that's going to be the death of me. Mm. Because I'm sitting here going, all right, what are we going to have? Eight classes and five races. I'm going to have to make 40 characters.
Yeah. Now, another interesting part about the Ranger that is expanded from Guild Wars 1 is the ability to melee. Now, of course, you can do that now. You just throw a sword in your hand, but they actually have mechanics built around melee with a ranger. And for anyone who's played like DDO, you know, when you play a ranger in DDO, they have, the ability to dual wield. But the melee with the ranger in Guild Wars 2 is kind of more about acrobatics, essentially. This interview on PC Gamer, they talk about the fact that you can you have these different skill sets that you can do, these different skills that are made specifically for the ranger that set it apart from the warrior's melee. You know what I mean? Like if you're like, well, if I'm going to play with a sword, I mean, the ranger can even wield a greatsword. So if you're going to play with a greatsword, why not just play a warrior? Well, they actually go into detail on that, and they say that there are just different skills for the ranger's melee abilities, like such as there's a skill chain where you, what is it called, Hornet Strike, I think?
Something like Hornet that. Sting.
Sting, yeah.
Where you love the skill.
Yeah, and there's ones where you attack, and then you jump up, and you kick them back, and then you can kind of like, you know, flip and do all this crazy stuff.
Well, then you zip like 50 feet away.
Yeah, and then they even explain from there you can pull out your bow and you can shoot since you're now at a distance. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be more acrobatic. Well, when I was reading that, I couldn't help but think, does this mean that the melee version of the ranger has replaced the assassin?
You know, it's a really valid question because if you're playing an assassin, and I don't want to get into the whole assassin thing, but if you're generally playing an assassin well, you zip in, do your damage, zip out. You get in, do it, get out fast.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what the ranger's doing here.
Yeah. So it's cool to see that they have that little acrobatic part in there as well. And when you think about it, man, the ranger really has a lot going for it. You know, you have the ranged weapons, you have the pets, you have the traps, nature spirit, buffing, and even melee. I mean,
you know, the versatility is incredible. The versatility of the Guild Wars 2 Ranger makes this possibly, for me, one of the most exciting reveal we've seen. Mm-hmm. And this is coming from someone that lost her mind when the Ellie was revealed. But seriously, I mean, there's so much you can do here, and the potential is incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm really excited about it. I know a lot of hardcore Ranger lovers are probably going out of their mind as well. It's really exciting. And we saw that video that they had on the blog, right? And that video, I mean, I don't even know where to start. Like, you see the, I love the part where she lays down the fire and then she backs up and she shoots the bow, and they're showing that you can shoot the arrows off from the fire and it'll, they won't catch on fire. But when you, she turned and then she shot the arrows through the fire and they caught on fire. And this is something that we read about before, we heard about before, but now we see it in action. And that's so cool because then the arrows went through the fire and hit the little, devourers, mini devourers, and then they caught on fire. And, you know, I mean, it, that's so cool.
I actually noticed that too. The detail that it takes to only send the arrows in, only the arrows that go through the fire are the ones catching on fire. That sounds completely ridiculous, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
The detail and involvement needed to do that really impressed me.
Yeah. And I just can't imagine from like a, even like a server side, you know, a technical aspect, how much work that must have been to be able to do something.
Oh my gosh, I know.
And especially when you're involving other, other players, like you set up the fire and another player shoots their arrows through your fire. Like that's just, that's incredible.
Well, that's something that has impressed me from the word go here when we started learning all of this is the encouragement and rewards given when you group with other players and combine your skills.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it's so much more than the sum of its parts in this case.
Yeah. Yeah, so Ranger fans, I think you're going to be very happy.
You know what? And we have to, I want to go back to pets for just a second because we have to point out again that you can have a shark as a pet.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm sorry, but that is so cool.
Yeah, they specifically mention the fact that you can have a shark, and a few of the other ones actually, they mention like snow leopard, but they talk about it being more stealthy, talk about a bear, moa bird. Is that all? I think that's about all.
You can have jellyfish. Someone said jellyfish. And I actually want to hear from our listeners on this. I know I saw a Great Dane in that video.
Mm.
I absolutely, Scooby-Doo went running through that video. And I want to know if anybody else, or was that something else? Am I seeing this wrong? But I froze that stupid thing about half a dozen times. And it was the coolest looking Great Dane went flying through there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I'll check that out. Now, the inclusion of sharks and jellyfish show us, again, that we have this underwater battle. You know, the underwater combat and the ability to do this. And that's incredible to me. You know what I mean? Like you can jump in the water and you can summon your shark or whatever, and it's going to swim right alongside you and attack people. How fun is that going to be?
Well, and that's going to be fantastic, but that's what was so cool about it to me were the implications. I mean, you know, it's pretty badass to have a shark pet.
Yeah.
But the implications, what that tells us is that underwater combat is extensive enough and in depth enough to warrant this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I imagine that's what it's going to be, especially since I imagine there's going to be, you know, cities underwater and all that they've talked about a little bit. Another one that I just remembered from the video, didn't they have like a flock of birds?
Oh yeah, something about falcons, and now I forget what it was, but.
They're like, what, three or four birds at once?
Hunter's call. He used that, and they came down, and I assume they pecked the guy's eye out.
Now, does that mean that that's just a skill to like summon or to call birds that are already existing, or does that mean that like they're your birds?
I am going to vote that that's just a skill because they did specifically say Hunter's call is what that is.
Okay. And yeah, I guess that would make sense.
I assume, but still, that was pretty awesome too.
Yeah, yeah.
I got a kick out of that, and oh my gosh, so many Hitchcock jokes.
Yeah.
Seriously.
What I thought was interesting too, at the end of this PC Gamer interview, they talk about the fact that the future classes that they haven't revealed yet are going to, some of them are ones that we already know, but they specifically mention that they're going to be renamed to show to better reflect their abilities and what they stand for. So with that in mind, we already knew that they were going to have new classes that they were going to introduce, but I wonder if that means that that's how they're counting them as new, like that they're maybe still a mix of previous ones we saw, but then they renamed them and added some new stuff. So, you know.
You know, I'm on the fence about that. I can't decide if I would love to see some sort of like a combined Paragon Dervish something or other. And we have something that we're familiar with and that we know and that we love. Or if I want something completely new. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I'm trying not to think about that too hard because I'm worried that I'm going to be disappointed.
I would almost rather see a reworked, something that, you know, that we've already seen. Maybe. Yeah, because I think if you think about it, you know, the roles, the class roles have all been filled. And yeah. I think even with like the Paragon and the Dervish, they were getting a little, I hate to say desperate, but it was almost like, it was like they were taking, you know, the basic melee class and kind of going, well, what if we spin them? Or, you know, what if we have them throw, spears? And it's not to say that those are bad. It's just to say that it was almost like taking a role, which could have been a sub role of a different one. You know what I mean? And it seems like in Guild Wars 2, they're doing that. You know, they're making this ranger so versatile that it doesn't need to be broken up into these different, these little subclasses. And because of that, we already know they're making these giant versatile classes with so much going for them that they're going to soak a few in together as one and just call it, you know, one new name. And I think that's the way they're going to go. That's just kind of my gut.
You know, you're probably right. I think ArenaNet has just spoiled me, though. I just kind of expect them to blow my mind at this point and do something amazing that I never even thought of. Uh-huh. So I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. One of us is right. So no matter what happens, Guildcast was correct. See, we can spin things too.
We should do that on every subject. Just, you know, every topic. We'll just go contrasting on it, and then we'll be like, we were right. See?
Yeah, and then, you know, as is convenient, we will refer to ourselves as a singular entity.
Yeah, as is convenient. Okay, let's get into the Warren Crichton news. You want to talk a little bit about this? What's going on?
Yeah, the Warren Crichton ended. I say we, if you're a white mantle, I'm sorry, but we did kick your butts, and the people of Crichton won. And I was wondering last week, it seemed, you know, there were a lot of loose ends. Kieran Thackeray had wandered off and nobody knew where he was. I'm still curious about Avenya. Last we saw, she was standing outside Ascalon City complaining that King Adelburn would not grant her an audience. And she was wanting him and his people to come help. And an update came down last night. We're recording this on Friday. An update came down last night and you went into your Hall of Monuments and Gwen, you know, she's hanging out in her place. And four of the Crichton allies that have been jumping out of trees and helping us for the past few months came in to talk to her and let her know that Captain Langmar was killed. And I got all choked up and sad.
Aww.
But she did. They think she got hit by spectral agony and that killed her.
Oh.
Which leads the question, I wonder if she was infused.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I thought you were going to say, why wasn't she infused?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's still, I know when I get hit with it, I'm infused, and it's still hitting me for 9999, so I don't know, maybe there are like 1,000 of them. But what happened, and I'm actually going to read this verbatim, we organized an extensive search of the area around Lesser Giant's Basin and even searched the lake bottom as best we could. On the very north side of the lake, we found a fresh, shallow grave that we believe holds the remains of Captain Langmar. As such, we believe that Kieran Thackeray survived the jump into the water and somehow managed to swim to the north side, dragging Captain Langmar's injured body with him. So then she died, they found her body, and Kieran has disappeared. His tracks headed north for a ways, and then they just stopped. So he has disappeared, and they gave her all of this, and they let her know. She has organized a search party and sent them out to get started, and then she hung out in the Hall of Monuments and cried.
Aw.
I know, and it was all very, and I know this is completely sappy. I sat there wiping my eyes while I was reading this. Oh. But I think that's actually a compliment to ArenaNet. It's partly that I'm sappy. But they have gotten us so involved in this story that we actually, I mean, you know, a lot of us, we really care about these people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we get involved in their story, and especially Gwen, you know, that's,
I mean, it's Gwen.
Yeah. It's a Gwen.
And she's still, I mean, she's going to have a huge, huge presence even years from now. And we'll get to that when we talk about the book. But for now, the war in Krita is over, but it leaves scars. And I know that sounds completely melodramatic, but historian Murrow, our White Mantle, our War in Krita correspondent, has an entry from July 12th saying, you know, the war in Krita is over. And he says, now healers tend to the wounded, soldiers bury their comrades, and many former rebels return to their farms and settlements. So the war's over, but all of this is still going on, and we still have so many people we haven't heard from that have played huge parts in this. So I think this was probably just the first of what we're going to hear about what happened to everyone. So, and Arena Nev, if you're listening, I really need to know what happened to Avenya.
Well, we know what happened to Salma, right?
Yes, she is now Queen Salma. If you are in an instance that is post-war Krita, she is now Queen Salma instead of Princess Salma.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. That's very cool. But, man, I got this list here of people, and I need to know. This is important.
Well, cool.
So that's what's going on with the war in Krita. It was, you know, overall it was a very small update, but it was pretty significant. So we'll see what happens.
Cool. Well, let's see. Let's go into the book now. This was going to be our big topic, of course, until we didn't, you know, of course we didn't know the Ranger was going to be announced, but, the book, The Ghost of Ascalon, was co-written by, Matt Forbeck and Jeff Grubb. Now, Jeff Grubb, of course, is the kind of the world builder on Guild Wars now. He works at ArenaNet. He came in for Nightfall. He wrote the storyline for Nightfall, Eye of the North, and now for Guild Wars 2. He is an accomplished writer. Actually, both of them are very accomplished writers. Jeff Grubb wrote, this is the thing that kills me. Like, he wrote some books in Dragonlance and Forgotten Realms, but he wrote Azerbaijan's. And for anyone who's my age, they probably remember Azerbaijan's because I think it was around 19, probably 89 or 90, they had the game from TSR that came out, Curse of the Azerbaijan's, which was, I played it on the Commodore 64, and it was one of the ones that came out after Polar Radiance and like Hillsfar and things like that. And these were the games that I grew up on. You know, these are the games that I played every single day, me and my friend. And Curse of the Azerbaijan's was a great game. It was such an amazing game, and we had so much fun with it. It was one of the first ones in that series, I believe, that was like a 3D, like a first-person view where you walk down the halls and everything. I believe. I don't remember if there was one before that was actually like that. But like Bard's Tale was like that too. But it was an incredible game. And to think that Jeff Grubb is the one who wrote the book that inspired the game. And then here he is now writing for Guild Wars. I mean, that's incredible. That's really cool. And I fanboy out about this stuff all the time. You know, I get so, it's kind of ridiculous, but it's just kind of my thing. You know, E3, I met, Brian Fargo, a guy who made, you know, Bard's Tale and Wasteland and things like that. You know, started Interplay, and I just completely, I mean, it's like, it's an unnecessary fanboyism, I think. Well, not unnecessary, but it's kind of unexpected, I guess. A lot of people don't really get like that with, you know, developers from the old days, but that's kind of the way I am with Jeff Grubb because of the fact that he inspired so much that directly inspired me, you know. Mm-hmm. So we get this book, Ghosts of Ascalon. It's written by Jeff Grubb, Matt Forbeck, and it's actually the first book in the trilogy that will explain a little bit of the time period before Guild Wars 2 and in between Guild Wars 1 and Guild Wars 2. You know, there's 250 years there that need to be explained. But the thing is, this one starts out only a year before Guild Wars 1. So we have that story. One thing that I think we're going to talk more about the interview itself. We're going to play that interview later. But something that Jeff said was that the other books in the series are their own stories. Like, they're just separate. They're their own things. It makes me believe that I think we were wrong in assuming that these are in order chronologically, mm-hmm. Perhaps these other stories might go back to different times within that 250-year period. So, Ghost of Ascalon, let's talk about that a little bit. I'm going to – well, first, let me just say – without spoilers. I'm going to say a little, talk a little bit about it without spoilers, and then I'm going to get into the spoiler part. So the book I think is fantastic. I wrote up a little thing about it, my impressions of it over at Massively. If someone wants to read it, we'll put the link to it. Overall, I think the book is fantastic, and I understand the fact that I'm a fanboy and that I, you know, that I would, automatically think that about a Guild Wars book. But it's like I said in my impressions article, you know, being a fanboy and being a lore nerd for Guild Wars kind of makes it where it could go either way. I could either be like a Tolkien scholar who watches Peter Jackson films and says, oh my God, you know, they got that wall is on, you know, it faces north instead of south, you know, on Minas Tirith. And it's like one of those things where I could be like that, or I could just be like overlooking any inaccuracies just because of the fact that it's a Guild Wars book.
Well, just enjoy yourself.
Yeah. Well, I tried to go between that. You know, I tried to honestly just look at it from an open mind, which I did. And I think it's a fantastic book. I think it was written beautifully. It flows well. I mean, I'm the type of guy, when I sit down and read a book, I'll fall asleep after two pages. and it doesn't matter how good it is. It's just the way I am. And this one, I actually, you know, because I had a week to read it, I would do that. I would fall asleep, but then I would wake up 10, 15 minutes later and then be like, oh, yeah, I gotta finish reading the book, you know, and then I would read it. Like I was telling you, I'd read like four chapters then, you know, I could stay up after that. It's something that I would read and put down and want to pick back up and read again, because it was, you know, even after I finished it, it was kind of like, I had this feeling in the back of my mind, like, oh, I need to keep reading that. Like, what's going to happen next? You know, what's happening? And it was kind of sad that it was over, but,
Well, I think that's the hallmark of a well-done book.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that, you know, the writing style was just incredible. I'm a big fan of flowing book that doesn't kind of get caught up in little details, you know. Mm-hmm. A lot of George R. R. Martin's books are like that. You know, we were talking about that, where, you know, every little description of the flowing curtains, you know, there'll be a two paragraphs on how the curtains flow. And it's like, I don't want to know all that stuff. I just want to know what's going on. And that's exactly how these are written.
That kills me. And we had talked about that before, because I want to read Song of Ice and Fire series so badly. And I can't do it.
Yeah. And that's not, you know, not to say anything bad about it. It's just not the style that I like to read.
Right.
So to me, this is a perfect style. You get introduced to the characters, not the characters that you see in the original trailer. Now there is a mention of Logan Thackeray. There's a mention of, Ritlock. There's a mention of Ritlock in there. Actually, he plays a little part in there. And we're told though that these are just kind of cameos. You know, they are going to come back later in the series. So we'll see more of them. So, I like that part of it. I like the fact that we're also introduced to the different races. It gets a little cliche in that part, I think. You know, you have one of each of the races, and then they all have to explain, you know, there's the part when they sit at the campfire and they all explain how they view the gods, and then they explain, how they, you know, just like their legends and everything.
Yeah, so, exposition.
It's kind of cliche in that part where it's like, we have to tell people about this. How are we going to do it? Well, let's have them sit in front of a campfire and just talk about it. But I understand that stuff has to be done. You know what I mean?
Right.
Can't really blame them for that. And it, you know, the book can't be the size of the stand, you know? So it's got to be something that kind of still gets that information out quickly. That isn't really a big down for me. I think if I were to nitpick at all, which is, it's getting desperate here even to nitpick. I think some of the, it does seem a little hurried in the explanations of a lot of things, because it is like that, where it's like, you know, you have these 2-page long combat sequences, and then they explain some of the backstory in 2 paragraphs. You know what I mean? So what I'm thinking is they're probably going to go back to a lot of that. One good example is The Legend of Gwen. I'll talk about that in the spoiler part, but that's a part that I think they covered in like 2 paragraphs, and it was like, whoa, I wanted to hear more about that, you know?
Yeah.
But that's again, being very nitpicky. I think it's an amazing book. I think that if you're a Guild Wars player from the beginning, you're going to love it because of the story that's in there. Mm-hmm. If you're, someone who is like never played Guild Wars 1, but you're anticipating Guild Wars 2, I think it's great. Although you might be a little lost at some of the references, especially like the cities and everything. You know, they talk about Ascalon and Ebon Hawk and all this, and you might be like, and they talk about it being in Rin. And you're like, well, I don't know where Rin is, but, actually they have a map at the beginning though, so, which helps out. But,
oh, that map is so cool.
Yeah. So that's essentially my impressions of it. I think that they have the first chapter on the website, right? Is it on the website or is it on?
The first chapter is on the website and we can add a link to it. But here is something very cool that I actually just found a few minutes ago. All three chapters, like this is a three chapter book. The first three chapters are available on iBooks.
Hmm.
Now, the problem is some people were having a little bit of a tough time finding it. So there is someone on the Guild Wars 2 Guru forums did screenshots of every page of chapters 2 and 3 so everybody can read them.
Wow.
Yes, so I want to put a link to that in the show notes because they're absolutely, I mean, they're crystal clear, and this is a way to read the book even if you don't have an eye something.
So I imagine that it's free, right, those first three chapters?
Yes, it is free.
Okay. Okay.
And there, it's through iBooks, but if you can't access that for some reason, there are, I'm just scrolling through this. Every page is here and we need to hurry this up so I can read it.
Yeah, it's, that's pretty cool that they do that. Plus, of course, the first chapter is on guildwars2.com. And, they also have the map that I talked about. They show that on guildwars2.com, which shows the map of Guild Wars 2, which is really interesting. If you sit there and you look at it and you kind of know the area, you'll see certain things that are like, whoa, how did that change? Or why did that change? Or, you know what I mean? It's pretty cool, I think.
Oh yeah, it absolutely is. Now there's an overlay floating around out there somewhere. Somebody took the new map and the current map and did an overlay.
Oh, okay.
So you could see how it changed. It was really neat.
That's cool. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about, more specifically about the book. Now, of course, if you don't want to hear it, you can skip ahead to the 1 hour, 16 minute and 58 second mark. If you go right in there within a second or two, you should be good. So skip ahead to that part and you will skip the entire part where I talk about the spoilers, and then you will play the interview with Jeff Grubb after that. So here we go. Spoilers. You ready?
Yay. I am.
If you don't want to hear spoilers, turn it off now. Last warning. Ready?
Okay, really?
You really ready? Okay. Okay, so let's go through the book itself a little bit, I guess, point by point. Now, the team, this is it kind of stars, I guess, the main character is Duokeen, and he is a character that it's not really made clear what type of class he is, although I think it's pretty peculiar to think that he, like, does lockpicks. He's kind of a rogue type of a character. But the reason he's brought into this group, he's kind of hired by the Vigil because he wants to, or because he can, he has some knowledge of Ascalon City. Now, Ascalon City, of course, at this point is completely destroyed, and it's overrun by ghosts. It's overrun by the ghosts of the people who were in Ascalon when the Faux Fire started. Now, the Faux Fire is, it was created by this Claw of Kanur. I think that's how you pronounce it. Kanur?
I'm thinking Kanur.
Kanur? Yeah, and that's
the Claw of Kanur should do an intro for us.
this is a char weapon that was very, very powerful, and it started the Faux Fire. And the Faux Fire essentially, well, that combined with King Adelburn's sword. Now, I'm kind of dancing around that part because it's told differently by the Char and the humans. Mm-hmm. They each have their own version of it. The humans believe that when the Claw and King Adelburn's sword met in battle is when the Faux Fire started, and it basically killed all of the Char in the area, and it turned all of the humans into ghosts. And this was a curse that King Adelburn did on purpose. Like, this is something that he set up on purpose to kind of, I don't know, to end the war and also to freeze time, I guess. Cause those ghosts in Ascalon City, well, as we'll find out at the end of the book, are frozen in time, and they're wandering the city, still thinking that they're, you know, defending against the Char. And, and King Adelburn is still there, you know, yelling at his, at everyone to, you know, get ready for the attack and stuff like that. And he's been doing this for 250 years, you know.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it's a pretty incredible, that part is incredible. But again, that's at the end of the book. So Dooku Keen, he has been to Ascalon City before and he has seen this. He went there actually to get a treasure. One of his, he was in the Ebon Vanguard and one of the people in his little group, found a map. And they went to go find this treasure, but of course everyone died except for him. He made it out alive, and he lived to tell about it. So they want to get him back, get his knowledge of Ascalon City, because he's one of the only people, or perhaps the only person that's ever gone to Ascalon City and lived to tell about it. So there's Dougal, there's he is joined by a human part of the vigil, and then also a Char named Ember, who is part of the vigil as well. And then there's a Savari and a an Asura. Now, oh, and a Norn too. So we get one of everything. The Norn is actually, at the very beginning of the book, there's a different Norn with them. And actually a different Asura too. And the original Norn dies, but the second Norn is actually a cousin to the first one. The Asura starts out, the first couple chapters of the book you read are not, that's not the party that goes throughout the rest of the book. You know, the Asura that's in the first chapter is kind of I think his name is Krag. And I'm really bad at names, so you have to forgive me if I don't get these names right. And this is all, I should have wrote notes or something, but I'm completely going from memory here, but,
Klag. It's Klag.
Klag, that's what it is. Yeah, Klag, he hired these guys to get this, Golem's Eye. So it's kind of like a Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, Indiana Jones kind of a thing at the very beginning. Then he, you know, he leaves the scene because he does not like what Dougal did, because Dougal actually took the Golem's Eye from him. That's kind of not really an important part of the story, but, so he has the eye, he is able to go to Ebonhawk through an Asura gate very reluctantly. Dougal hates Asura gates. He goes from Lion's Arch to Ebonhawk through the Asura gate, which I guess introduces us to the fast travel, you know, the map travel part of it, going through Asura gates like that. Because the story starts in Divinity's Reach, goes down to Lion's Arch, and then they warp over to Ebonhawk. So in Ebonhawk is when they meet the rest of the group is when they meet the Asura, because the rest of the group, they all met in Lion's Arch. So they meet the Asura. He's this kind of a quirky, mad scientist kind of a guy. He's very intelligent, and he has this bag full of stuff that is hilarious, because he has this potion, and he's like, I have this potion I made. Can you take it? If somebody's wounded, please take it, because I don't know if it works. And people are like, I don't know if I want to do that. So it's kind of funny. And he's like that with a lot of stuff. And he actually kind of saves the day at the end with one of his little gadgets that he makes. But, I like that part of it, because it introduces us to the kind of gadgeteering that the Asura are able to do. So,
cool.
So you have this party, they go out, they set forth, they meet many, they have a lot of problems along the way, a lot of battles. There's one part where they're going through the sewers of Ebonhawk, underneath it, and they have to escape, and they're like, it's really descriptive. Let's just say that. It's really, it's pretty nasty. Once they get out of that, they meet a band of Char, and pretty much the rest of the book from there, I would say half the book is dealing with being in the Char lands and dealing with the Char. Until they get to Ascalon City, of course, and they deal with the ghosts. But there's a lot of dealing with the Char, and that's the point when we meet Ritlock. And Ritlock is a very, he's like their commander, lord. You know, they talk about the fact that he is such a powerful, he's a hero. You know, he's in that Heroes Guild, or he was part of that Heroes Guild that broke up. So it's really cool, because you get to look behind the scenes of the Char, and you get to kind of see how they work. You know, they're walking through these Char lands, where they're acting like the Char in the group, Ember, has the rest of them as hostages. And that's how they're kind of playing it, so that they can, it's kind of that Star Wars thing, you know, where they act like, Chewbacca was the, was the prisoner. You know what I mean? It's, yeah. It's the exact same thing.
but, right down to the Chewbacca.
Yes. And, well, Ember, you know, has them be the prisoners. Actually, it's a switcheroo because before they had Ember be the prisoner when they walked through Ebonhawk so that they wouldn't, because the Ebonhawk, you know, the Vanguard would not go, they would not go for the fact that there's a Char in behind the city right. walls. So they did the old switcheroo. Now it's Ember's turn to have the humans and the, well, yeah, just the humans, as prisoners. But what's funny is the Char overlooked the fact that there's a Norn, Savari, and a Sura in the group because they generally accept them still. You know, so we learned that the Char are not just hating everyone, they just hate humans. So, So the party is able to go through. They have a couple little conflicts here and there, a couple times where they have to fight some Char. Really descriptive battle scenes. I really loved it, battle scenes. And then once they get to Ascalon, they meet the ghosts. We get to see kind of how battle works with ghosts, which I think is really interesting. Mm-hmm. Essentially, they're slicing at the ghosts back and forth until it says they describe the ghost as kind of like an ectoplasm. Where okay. they break apart in this ooze that kind of wisps away, but then after a few minutes, it'll reform. So like, when they're killing ghosts, they're like, okay, we gotta get out of here because these things are gonna reform in like 10 minutes. So.
It's like a crazy respawn.
Yes, exactly. So I think that's what I'm saying is it's like they're explaining the respawn, which is a pretty cool way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So they get into the city, they're looking for this claw, and it's at the bottom of where the faux fire started, which is indicated by a giant light that's coming out of the ground and shooting up into the sky. So it's really easy to see where this claw is. You know, they understand that that's where it's at. So they just have to follow the light. So they go in, they go into the king's treasury room, which is where the hole is and where the faux fire is shooting out of the ground. And they meet a guy who was King Adelburn's scribe. And this guy explains to them that he's the one that wrote these maps, these treasure maps, because he wanted people to come and save him. He essentially died before the faux fire. So he is not bound to the same time period as the rest of Ascalon. So he knows, like he's aware that he is sitting here and it's been 250 years and he doesn't have anything to do, you know, but the other ones aren't aware of that. They're
Can
so,
y'all bring
they're,
me a magazine.
Yeah, exactly. So he is so excited to see the party. But what happened was he was killed by King Adelburn. King Adelburn did not like him for various reasons and he killed him. He stabbed him with a knife before he set off the faux fire. So this scribe is essentially like, thank you for coming. I wrote, you know, I made all these maps and I basically threw them up in the wind to be carried away and they didn't go very far. And so I thank you for coming. And he's like, yeah, you know, help yourself to whatever you need. And at one point, he's trying to save them. He's trying to help them out, but he knows that he can't because the ghosts are pretty much all seeing. So King Adelburn finds them. He tells the guards to get him. So there's all these guards. There's this giant fight, and there's this part where the scribe comes out and is kind of like, you know, Adelburn. And he says, you know, I'm getting my revenge now. I'm having these people help out because I want my revenge against what you did to me. So the king goes up to him and takes the knife out of his chest, the ghost knife out of his ghost chest, and kills him again. And this time the scribe disappears and says, thank you. So it was essentially like that was what he needed to vindicate himself in order to truly move beyond. You know what I mean?
To move on.
Yeah. And I think that was a really cool little part.
Oh my gosh, this is so cool.
Yeah. And Adelburn he's a formidable foe, I guess you could say. He's a kind of a tough guy and he explains a lot about why he did certain things. A lot of it was because of his son. You know, as we learn in Guild Wars 1, you know, Rurik and King Adelburn were not exactly, you know, on
they
the same
level. They didn't see eye to eye. Yeah,
exactly. So he had a lot of animosity towards his son. And then the fact that he fought with him just before he went out and died in the Shiver Peaks, mm-hmm. you know, that was something that always bothered him. So he was really touchy about Rurik. Dougal actually talks about Rurik to him, which kind of sets him off even more. But they end up defeating King Albarn, actually, in the end, and they get the claw, which I guess there's no, you know, we kind of figured that would happen. But I think what's funny is it's kind of down in a well. They have to go down in this well, and they have to, Dougal goes down there, and because he's the kind of the trap master, you know, he has to set up, disable the traps and everything. And he gets the claw, and he also grabs, he looks, there's this treasure room, it's enormous. It's got all this platinum and, you know, weapons and all this stuff. And he's like, I just need to take this stuff. So he takes a bag of platinum. And then at the end, while he's trying to escape the well, he's like, I don't have room for this in my bag. You know, so he had to drop it. And I was
his
like,
his inventory was full.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, we've all been there. You know, I know exactly what you're talking about. So that, I thought that was kind of funny. Actually, a lot of the times in the book, when they introduce, little things like that, like even the way that some of the spells work, it's like, oh yeah, that's pretty cool. Because, you know, we know it from the game itself. But at the very end, the other human vanguard who's with the party, this female, she ends up betraying Dougal. She won't let him out of the well. She has a rope down there to help him climb back up, and she actually cuts the rope and says, see ya. And he's like, oh, great. Now what am I going to do? You know, so she betrays him, but then what happens is Ember, who we thought died, I'm going to get into that, all the people who died, because pretty much everyone died in the party. I know. Ember, who we thought died, actually is still alive and comes and kills the female. Wait, does he kill her? I think he just... I can't remember. Anyway.
He sends her to a down state.
Yeah, he sends her to a down state, exactly. I guess they... You know, Dougal's actually able to climb out, and then they kind of make amends with Ember. And, you know, because Ember is a char who is not happy about being in a group of humans, and they constantly fight about it. You know, anytime there's anything is brought up, they just fight about it and fight about it. So it's kind of cool to see Ember at the end there, kind of giving the nod.
Well, why did she leave him in the well?
Well, the claw originally, he sent the claw up on the rope. And she's like, okay, yeah, just send it up and I'll get, it's again, it's the Indiana Jones thing, you know,
right.
It's like, you just give me the skull and I'll help.
Yeah, everybody should know better than that.
Yeah, exactly. Seriously. Hasn't he seen Indiana Jones? I mean, oh wait. Yeah. Or,
you know, still, you never sent the thing up first.
Yeah. So then she took it and then she's like, sucker. But she doesn't want it to go, essentially what's going to happen with the claw, the whole reason they're getting the claw is to make peace between the humans and Char, and she doesn't want that to happen. So she does not want it to be in the hands of the Vigil. We find out that there's a spy in the group also. There are spoilers I'm giving, but I don't want to give away all the spoilers, you know what I mean?
Right.
I still want people to buy this book and read it. So I'm not gonna, even though I'm giving away spoilers, I don't want to make it just completely...
You don't want to read us the whole book.
Yeah, I don't want to read you the whole book. So I think that's the reason she didn't do that. One other thing I want to talk about, though, they were kind of going back, you know, now that I did kind of a cliff notes of the plot line, one thing I thought was really interesting was how they described the classes. We already know about the warriors, elementalists, and rangers now. But they described the necromancer in great detail. I think the Savari necromancer was done, her name is Killeen. It was so brilliant the way they did it. The explanations that they had for her being a necromancer, essentially revolved around the fact that she was, you know, the entire Savari race is 25 years old or less than 25 years old. Mm-hmm. She herself was 5 years old. So, she was very naive on many things, but she also was very intelligent because she had, the dream, you know, where she's able to, you know about the dream, right? The Savari dream?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So, yeah, the dream is essentially where all Savari can learn, from the previous Savari. So, and also they also learn, Ventari, like what he had in his mind and, you know, everyone else who has, I don't know, it's like a collective learning process. It's like the internet for Savari, I guess. It's like
the Borg.
Yeah.
I keep thinking Borg, but then I...
It's like a Wikipedia for Savari, but so they, but they all learn this stuff in their minds through this dream. And it's not like a sleeping dream, you know, it's like a, it's just what they call it. So she knows stuff, but she doesn't know the practical applications of stuff. You know what I mean?
She doesn't know it firsthand.
Yeah. And so a lot of experiences are new to her. So she's fascinated by death. You know, Savari cannot die unless they're killed, kind of like elves, I guess. So she's fascinated by death, and she takes this fascination into necromancy. You know, she's, she loves to look at corpses and just be like, it's fascinating that this thing was alive, you know, 2 minutes ago, and now it's not. And then she remarks a lot about how things would make a nice minion or nice corpse, zombie minion, kind of things like that. She, at one point, she, looks at Dougal and she says, you would make a perfect, I think she calls it, I forgot the exact word she calls it, but you know, she meant like zombie. Like, you'd make a perfect zombie. And he's like, look, he actually has to make an agreement with her. Look, if one of us dies, do not bring one of us back, because we don't want an animated version of us, a reanimated version of us, fighting alongside of us, because they fight this group of Vanguard and she brings one of them back. And, the other female, Vanguard, the human in the party knew that girl before. And she's like, no, don't bring these people back. Like, I don't want to see them in this state. Like, her face is ripped off and all this stuff. And the Savari didn't understand that. She's like, I don't understand. And then it hits her and she's like, oh, I didn't even think that that would offend you. I'm very sorry. So I would say was my favorite part right there. Because
she just didn't have the world experience to understand that that is creepy and horrible.
Yeah, exactly. And to put that, it's something you wouldn't even think about. You know what I mean? Like, if you look at a Savari and you're like, yeah, their race is 25 years old. Yeah, she's 5 years old. They learn stuff. The end. No, it's when you put that into a real kind of working application, that's exactly what would happen. She would not understand that reanimating that corpse would offend people. And even the Char didn't really understand it, because they basically burn their dead and that's it. You know, they leave them and that's it. So it was kind of a thing that they're like, oh, you know, humans are peculiar because they bury their dead and they don't want to see them again, you know, in a reanimated figure. So that was fascinating. Her whole interest in death, the way she would bring things back. And, there were a few curses she did. They were fighting these elementals and this like giant like earth elemental, and she was doing some curses on it. Plus she also did a healing buff on the Norn while he was fighting, where he would, every hit he made, he would kind of steal the life back, you know, like,
oh really?
Like, yeah. And so, and it was like he was all cut up and everything, but every time he hit this elemental, his wounds would heal, and it was pretty cool, like, because it's like, oh yeah, I know what that is.
Life-stealing.
Yeah, so I know exactly what that is. So it's kind of a cool way of kind of playing that into the book and, you know, tying it in. So yeah, I think that was really cool. The Asura, like I said before, the different potions they were making healing potions, and at the end, with the Golem's Eye, essentially what it is it animates a golem. You know what I mean? Like,
okay.
Like, that's how they're able to make the golem. It's the big crystal that's in the chest of a golem.
Yeah.
That's what it was. So, at the end, the other Asura got the golem's eye from Dougal. Dougal actually gave it to him and said, here, this is my, you know, present to you. And then he kind of saved the day with it by making a giant golem, to kind of clear out Ascalon of all the ghosts. I mean, it was a really kind of an epic ending. But it was all because of the Asura. But the sad thing is, and this is again, this is a big spoiler here, but, you know, Killeen dies, the Savari.
Oh!
I know. The Asura dies. Who else? The Norn does not die, but he's almost dead. He almost dies a couple times, actually. But he's a tough one. So yeah, there are some deaths in the party, and it's really sad, especially when Killeen dies. She's essentially smashed by the elemental, who falls on her, but,
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's really sad, because I really liked her a lot, but I think if everyone survived every book, you know, it would be too predictable and you wouldn't have that emotion in there, so.
Oh man, I need to read this.
Yeah, I don't know if I mentioned everything. I keep thinking of, oh yeah, I didn't talk about this, I didn't talk about that. Like I said, it's all basically from memory, but
Well, I think you explained everything nicely. I was like making mental notes of questions, and then you'd come back and answer them a minute later. So,
yeah, there's a, like I said, there's still a few big things that I don't want to give away. There's a whole part where Dougal, it's actually another really sad part where his wife is one of the ghosts in Ascalon, and
are you serious?
Yeah,
oh my gosh!
I know. Yeah, and he, well, she wasn't in Ascalon. Of course, you know, that was 250 years ago, but she wasn't in Ascalon when the Faux Fire happened. She was part of his original party when they went into Ascalon the first time for the treasure hunting. And, he essentially let her die because he ran and they were attacking her.
Aww.
So that always haunted him. And that was something that, you know, throughout the book, he's really haunted by the fact that he pretty much left his wife to die. So then when he goes back, he's really scared of seeing her again. You know what I mean? He actually sees the armor on the ground from her, from the last time he was there. And it really haunts him and it really freaks him out. And then at the end, he thinks he hears a voice when he's going to find the claw and he's down in that treasure area. And it's her, you know, and she's basically helping him out. Like it's almost like we get to see that she forgave him and she's helping him out to get this claw. He doesn't actually see her, but she guides him nonetheless. And, at the end, he's like, thank you. You know, he thanks her for helping. It's really sad. It's really powerful, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to need tissues when I read this, aren't I?
Yeah, you might.
Oh man.
So I hope that explains enough of it to get people interested, for those who don't mind spoilers, because I figured that I had to tell this stuff. One other thing, I guess I didn't even mention this and I was really looking forward to it. They also, name a mesmer in the,
This was huge.
Yeah. They say the Savari is a necro and they also mention a mesmer by name. Like they're, Dougal, I think it's Dougal. He's actually talking about the different types of magic and he's like, yeah, there's elementalists, there's necromancers, there's mesmers. And I'm like, Mesmer?
Wait a minute. Hey.
Yeah. And it's the only mention of it, but still it's there. So.
Well, and there's some speculation there, and I think it's a little far-fetched. Some people were saying, well, maybe they're just trying to throw us off, like Colleen was the very last necro, and she died, and then the profession died with her. And
see, I remember you talking about that. Did people already know that Colleen died?
No, that was just total speculation. So.
Okay.
Because this was like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, because I remember when I read the part when she died, and I was like, I thought that was just speculation, but okay.
No, I don't know. I'm going to be interested to see what happens, but it seems like a pretty sure bet for necros and mesmers.
Yeah.
And you and I are both happy about that.
Yeah, and I would say even probably some type of a rogue character, just because of Dougal, but...
Yeah, Dougal seems to indicate one.
Yeah, but he fights with a sword, and actually, he fights with an ebon black sword that he got from another person. And when he fights the ghosts with it, it actually hurts them more than regular swords. So I think that's kind of cool.
Ooh. You know, while you were talking about that, I went all DDO and I was like, oh, he needs a ghost touch weapon. So maybe that's what that is.
Yeah, I think it probably has some kind of bonus against undead or something. I think that's it. Did you have anything that I wasn't clear on that to clarify?
I don't think so. I'm fascinated by that treasure room. Do we get a good look at that?
Well, they explain, I guess the biggest thing about it is they explain all of the different, there's like a giant chest in the middle, just like you would picture in a treasure room. The claw was in the chest, and there was just spilling over with gold and platinum. It was a lot of artifacts, things like that. He said that he was actually hoping to find Adelburn's sword, like the original, but he didn't. So that's another one where it's like, I wonder if we'll see that later.
Yeah, that could be viewed as a hint. You know what I'd love to see is a big pile of bonus weapons stuffed in the corner.
Actually, well, they do talk about, just magical weapons in there. And he says he wants to take them all, but of course it can't,
Should have lurched before he left.
I know, seriously.
I wonder, you know what? I'll bet there will still be spare merchant stones floating around in 250 years. He should have one. No, but I just wonder, our look at the treasure room, And like Dougal's sword, I wonder how much of a look at Guild Wars 2 we're getting there and we just don't realize.
Yeah. I don't know. I think a lot of it is, like I said, it's hinting at not only the lore, but it's also hinting at some of the spells we're going to see, some of the, you know, the classes, how they're going to work.
Oh, yeah.
The Asura would ride on the back of the Golem, and also he rode on the shoulders of the Norn, which I don't think that's like something we can do in the game, but I think with the Golem part, riding the Golem, I would like to say that would be something we could see. They actually call him a Golemancer, which I don't know if that would be a class, because it seems like it would be something specific to Asura.
It would have to be race-specific.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe there's a line of skills that are race-specific to the Asura that have to deal with the Golem.
Yeah.
I would imagine.
I don't know. I wonder, as far as writing the Golem, I seem to remember, and I'm not looking at it, so I can't remember, but I feel like I remember the Asura riding in the crook of his arm. Is that...
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or is it like riding on his back?
No, there's... Well, let me think.
What I'm wanting to know is, can he move around as needed?
Yeah, he can. I think... I know for sure he was on the Norn's shoulders. For the Golem, it seems like... now, Clag was the one that was riding on the Golem, and that was only in the first chapter, but that one... I'm not really sure. I don't remember the specifics on where... I pictured it on his back... So that's why I'm saying that, and I'm not sure what it was exactly that made me picture it like that, but.
I don't know. What I'm wanting to know, though, is what this means for the game, because if I can play an Asura and get piggyback rides from a Norn, I am all about that.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you know, and I'm being silly, but seriously, I wonder how, if they approach that, the Asura's size in any way, shape, or form in the game. I mean, because, If you're an Asura and you're grouped with a Norn character and everybody's running in the same direction, it's not going to make a lot of sense if the Asura is keeping up. This is, I don't know, maybe I'm thinking about this in too much detail, but.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that it's one of those that we'll just have to wait and see, but it wasn't really clear. One other thing I want to mention too before I kind of, stop talking about spoilers is, I found it very interesting, the discussion about the legend of Gwen, because the way the humans told it, they said, yeah, you know, Gwen was a great warrior, and she, well, not warrior, you know, specifically, but she was a great person and a hero, and she's the one who, you know, kind of brought Ebonhawk to where it is today, or where it was at one point, and she made it, you know, into the great fortress that it is, and they talk specifically about Logan Thackeray being the descendant of Kieran and Gwen. Like, specifically, they say, "Yeah, did you know that that's Gwen's descendant, Kieran's descendant, and Gwen?" And they're like, "Oh no!" And they talk about the fact that she was tortured by Char. You know, they say that she, when the searing happened, you know, she was kidnapped by the Char, and which is stuff, you know, we learned all in Eye of the North. But then the Char, they're sitting around the campfire talking about this, and the Char hears this Ember, and she's like, "No, that's not how it happened at all. Gwen is a horrible person, and she is, you know, Gwen the Char Slayer. And she is just horrible. Like, she killed so many of our people for no reason."
And the humans are going, "Yeah, I know. That's why we like her."
Well, like, the humans are saying, "What? No reason? Like, are you serious? Like, that, you know, she was kidnapped by him and tortured." And Ember's like, no, she wasn't at all. Like, that didn't happen. So I think that's so interesting to hear the, you know, and they actually fight about it too. You know, to hear the kind of just the different vast differences in the way that everyone views everything. And that's the same with religions too. You know, they talk a lot about the religions. Of course, the Char cannot worship gods anymore. You know, they completely, except for the Flame Legion, they completely did away with worshiping gods.
Right.
They see that as one of the problems that why they, you know, didn't do so well in the human Char battles. So they see it like that. The Norn, of course, have their own, you know, they worship the bear and the tiger and the, you know, the different things like that. The Asura, they have the, what is that called? oh, I forgot what it's called, but they have a specific word for it, where it's basically like we're all part of a big mechanical, a big gear, essentially, and the only reason people die is because it's like it's wearing out, like that gear is wearing out.
Really?
And that's how they see it. They see it as a big mechanical thing. That's how they see, it's not so much religion, but that's how they see, like, I don't know how to say that. You know what I mean? Like, that's how they see the world. Spirituality, I guess. That's how they see
that. Yeah, just their worldview.
Yeah. And Silvari, of course, have the tree where they all come from. They all have the dream, the great dream. And they're 25 years old. So they don't have this, you know, huge backstory of gods and religion, but they do know all about how Ventari, you know, how he died at the tree and how they got his knowledge and all that stuff.
Well, so that, how all that came to be.
Yeah, so that's their version. So I think that is interesting, even though I said before that they explain it really quickly and kind of, you know, like, here's a whole bunch of information right now. Here it is. But it's cool to still hear that stuff, I think.
Well, I imagine that's a hard balance to strike because this book is for two very, very different groups of people. Mm-hmm. It's for people who are kind of interested in Guild Wars 2 and want to, and they're just interested in the book for that. But then it's also for those of us who have been playing for years and we know about the tree and we know about Ventari and we know what the Asura think about the giant gear and all that.
Yeah.
So I think there's that balance between explaining it to those who don't understand and boring to death those who do.
Yeah.
That's probably a fine line to walk.
Yeah, I imagine it is. And I don't know. I mean, it's still effective, you know, in the book and it still works, but.
Yeah. That's actually what I was going to ask. Do you feel like they struck that balance well?
Yeah, I think so because I still learned a little bit, and I still, like you said, you know, new readers are going to learn a lot. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's important.
It's a shame the book can't include wiki links because.
That's true, yeah. Okay, so, let's stop the spoilers now and, I will mark this time, and this is, so welcome back, people who didn't want to hear spoilers. This is,
Oh my gosh.
Now, one thing I did want to mention, though, that we talked about in the spoiler part that I don't think is really a spoiler is that, of course, we have the classes that have been revealed, and then we have the Necro, which we know about in the book as well, just from the first chapter, but there's also mention of a Mesmer. So, you know, anyone who did not want to hear the spoiler stuff, we didn't really talk too much about the Mesmer, but just the fact that they mention it once in the book, that there's a Mesmer. And I don't think that's a spoiler at all. I think that's...
No, but it's a specific mention of that class.
Yeah, so I'm excited.
I know, I can't wait. So how many days have we got on this book? 11? 11 days until the book is out.
Yeah.
It'll be 10 by the time this comes up.
All right, so yeah, I guess that's essentially about it. And now I'm going to play the interview that we did with Jeff Grubb. This is done, again, for Massively. But the audio itself was done for Guildcast. And I wanted to thank Jeff for letting us do that and letting us record and having the interview. He talks a little bit more detail about some of the specifics of the book itself, how it was written, his views on writing the book, things like that. A lot of it is it's kind of a general you know, interview that doesn't get into too many specifics because I wanted to keep it spoiler free.
Right.
So that's what we have.
But
so
he's got a lot to say about writing the book and about where they were coming from.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a very interesting interview. And I guess before I play it though, I'll just go ahead and do the kind of outro here. And, if you want to email us, you can email Sean at guildcast.com, S-H-A-W-N, or Ruby, R-U-B-I, at guildcast.com, and check out our Twitter, Facebook, and WordPress pages. The WordPress page is our main page. It's guildcast.wordpress.com. Send us those emails. Like I said, we have almost 30 pending, and I imagine we'll have a lot more after this one, a lot more. So we are going to do a dedicated email show next, and it will probably most likely be earlier than a week. We'll do it as an extra show. It's a little bonus show.
We need to get that out of the way. Yeah. Bonus shows are good. I don't. It's a good bonus show.
Yeah, and I don't want to read every email because I think a lot of times what we've been doing with emails reading stuff that we already answered or that hasn't been answered yet that nobody really knows the answer to.
Yeah.
So things like that, I think I'm going to skip. But anything we can answer, we'll read in the email. So
perfect.
Yep. So until next time, this is our little interview here with Jeff Grubb, and I hope you all enjoy.
See you next week.
Bye bye. All right. Thank you for joining us on this special edition of Guildcast. We have with us a very special guest. We have Mr. Jeff Grubb. How are you doing, Jeff?
Doing very well. Thank you.
Now, do you want to just tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do over at ArenaNet?
Well, I am a game designer. In particular, I work on content, which in my case is cinematic scripts, lore, the big picture of where the world is doing, and maintaining continuity, which is basically making sure we're all saying the same things about, you know, this particular location or that race or our Norn or acting like our Norn. In addition, I'm the co-author with Matt Forbeck of Ghost of Ascalon, our first novel.
Yes, that's actually what we wanted to talk to you about. Because I was actually able to read that book. I just finished it this morning, actually, and it was kind of an advanced copy, I guess. And it was, it was very. Now I could get into how, you know, kind of my impressions of it, but I won't hear. But I thought it was an incredible book. I mean, just an incredible story. It really ties well into everything that we know so far in Guild Wars and everything that we're looking forward to in Guild Wars 2. And of course, we have two more books to follow after this, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So we did have a few questions for you. We wanted to ask you, this is pertaining to the book itself and kind of the direction that it's going with the game. And my first question is, I was wondering about the emphasis on showing the different cultural perspectives in the book. This is something that we find very interesting. For instance, mm-hmm. the Legend of Gwen is told much differently between the humans and Char. Now, is this an example of what we can expect to see in the individual races' storylines? Like, will this groundwork be laid out in the game to make us feel more connected to our characters' culture and the feelings towards other races?
Yeah, our races are distinct. They have their own personality, and we reflect that in the game and in the lore. The humans and the Char have been fighting for centuries. And so they have different viewpoints, and that's one of the things a book allows us to do is to show those multiple viewpoints all coming into, as they look at the same fact, as they look at the same character, the Char have a very different view of Gwen than the humans do. How their world revolves, what they worry about is different for the different races. Humans are based out of Divinity's Reach. Their big initial conflicts are with centaurs and with bandits. Char are out of the Black Citadel, and they worry about the ghosts of Ascalon for the previous inhabitants and the Flame Legion. So, you know, all of them have their own viewpoint, and one of the stories of the game itself is how these viewpoints come together.
Following up on that cultural perspective for just a mm-hmm. second, you were talking about how they really view everything differently. Something kind of consistent in the book is that most of Dougal's, the human character, most of his companions seem to view him as almost a drag on the group. He's more of a hindrance than anything. And I understand the specific reasons for that, just the way they explained it in the book. But do you view humans in the game as an underdog race?
Well, Dougal, first off, has his own problem. He's carrying his own ghosts. He's carrying his own memories, which are, you know, making him less effective. And part of the story is his conquering those particular ghosts. But humans as a race have been kicked in the chops pretty much since GW1. We have steering, we have the sinking of ore, we have the rise of the dragons, we have the flooding of the Lion's Arch, we have Nightfall, we have the Foe Fire. All of these, they've been battered again and again. And this is one of the things that's cool about humans, is they're resolute. They're dedicated. They are, you know, they are standing fast against the darkness. Divinity's Reach is to the human minds, one of the last human lights in the world as they're going out across Tyria. Now the other races, again, we have different viewpoints. They say the humans, time may have gone. You know, they may be a dying race. They may be like the dwarves, and you know, their time, you know, has come and gone, and now it's new races that are coming on. One of the early pieces that was released as a preview, he's thinking about the Silvari and how they're young and they're vibrant and they're good and they're noble, and that really frustrates Dougal, because you know they haven't been around long enough to get, you know, kicked around the way the humans have.
I find that really interesting, and I think that in line with that, I wonder about when you were writing this book, were you consciously aware of balancing that excitement level for each race to make sure to keep potential players interested in finding that one that may suit them the best when the game launches? Because I know that, you know, you have to be careful to make sure that if someone already has a race in mind when they want to play the game, that you kind of make sure to balance that. Is that something that was conscious?
One of the things the book is intended to do is both to introduce new players to Tyria and to show long-term players how the world has changed. I really want people to finish this book saying, yeah, I want to be a Norn. And he goes, okay, the Char are really, really cool. This is how we can run an Asura. So we're looking at our typical characters in many cases here, because this is a first date for many people with Tyria. This is the first time they've really, you know, been able to get in deeply with it. And, you know, we have a lot more text to play with. We have a lot more things we can do in a novel. So as a result, I definitely wanted to give you the archetypes and have people come out with a book saying, yes, I want to play that race when it comes out. And it's going to be a different race. I want to start fights. I want to have people arguing which is better, Asura or Norn. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that sounds amazing. Now we're kind of talking about the characters, and I want to deviate for just a second. This is something I'm very interested in. It's a character-centered story, but how much can we expect to learn about the world of Tyria overall, as it's portrayed in Guild Wars 2, just through these three books?
Well, Tyria is a big world. Mm-hmm. We get a grand tour in Ghost of Ascalon. We're in Divinity's Reach, we're in Lion's Arch, we're in Ebonhawk, we're in the Dragon's Land, we're in Ascalon. We basically are hitting a lot of the major human and Char locations. Now, that's not the entire world. We've got a lot more, you know, we've got the Shipper Peaks, and we've got the Tarnished Coast, and we've got the Asura Lands, and the Norn Lands, and all sorts of stuff. But this is carrying the story through a lot of space to give people a feeling and a flavor, particularly for these cities, because each one has its own flavor and its own personality. The cities themselves are characters in the book, and Ebonhawk is very different from Divinity's Reach, and you can feel the friction between the two locations.
Awesome.
Now, we saw in one of the early trailers, we saw there were a few main characters that were speaking. Mm-hmm. There was like Logan, Ritlock, Ir, Zoja, and Kaith. And are these all going to be explained in the trilogy? Because I know that so far we've seen a couple in this first book, but I just want to know, mm-hmm, if, like, will we focus mainly on Dougal Keen, or will we switch main characters throughout the others?
No, each novel of this series is independent. And this is Dougal Keen's story here. This is the story of the Char and the humans coming to their truths. This is, you know, a piece telling the story of that particular era. And while a couple of the characters do make cameos, they do appear, those main characters, they have their own story. And that story will be told later. I was involved in Forgotten Realms many, many years ago. And what we did for the first, year of the Forgotten Realms, we had four novels with five authors, all of whom, you know, presented a different viewpoint, talking in a different area of the realms, talking about different stuff. So Tyria is a large living world, so we have a lot of stories to tell. So Ghost of Ascalon is one story, Edge of Destiny is another story. So, and the next one we do after that will be a different story as well. And characters can move over, characters can appear, we'll see people, you know, shift over, or results of their actions, coming to the fore, but they're all going to be independent novels.
With those next two books, like you mentioned, it's going to be a different story. Can you get into any specifics about whose story we're going to be hearing or what we're going to be hearing about in the next two?
I can tell you the next book is called Edge of Destiny.
Okay, cool.
Okay, awesome. Well, then I'll just jump to the next one here. We've got essentially 250 years between the storyline of Guild Wars and Ghosts of Ascalon. Was there a detailed story fleshed out to explain that gap, or just a basic outline, here's what happened and here's where we are now?
Yeah, back when we started this, the tail end of Eye of the North, Reese Hosby and I worked out 250 years of timeline during the interregnum between the end of Eye of the North and the beginning of Guild Wars 2. And we said, okay, we need this to happen. We need this to happen. A lot of it was driven by, okay, we want Char and Human to be able to be in the same party. Therefore, we have a truce. How does that happen? And we evolved a timeline. And when we started on the novel, we passed that in our stories and what we've generated over to Matt Forbeck with the question by the modern era, the Char and the humans have a detente. How did that happen? What are the details? And that evolved into Dougal's story and the hunt for the Claw of the Con Earth. Now, numerous outlines, more outlines and revisions, both we have Ghosts of Ascalon. So this is very much a novel that has grown up alongside the development of the game itself. And as things change, we change the book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now, what I'm wondering about along these same lines is, can we expect a prequel set of novels that are set in those 250 years before these novels?
Yeah, we can. There are a lot of stories that can be told in that interregnum between GW1 and GW2. Now, for new fans and people who are going to be coming to Guild Wars 2 for the first time, this is laying a groundwork. This is telling you what the history of the world is, bringing you up to date so when you, run into Logan, you have an idea who he is. And we know the problems with the dragon brain. And as well as telling our long-term players how we got there, how we got from human and Char fighting to the beginning of a truce, a very delicate ceasefire between the sides. There's a lot. I mean, we're big fans of GW1 and prophecies, and a lot of what we see in the game when we've laid things out or laid out our maps, we often talk about legacy sites, which is to say, what was here back in this time, is it still applicable? Or has it been, taken out as a result of the dragons and other disasters which have occurred? So if you're a long-term player, you can recognize that. But if you're a first-time player, you basically said, wow, this is really cool. We definitely go with the rule of cool.
I think that's a good rule to follow. I can't wait to see more of this. Now, as far as just writing these novels in general, you mentioned Forgotten Realms earlier. And you've been involved, you've done the Dragonlance books. How would you compare writing a novel about an MMO where this world is already developed as opposed to writing about a world that you helped create?
Well, I'm helping to create this one. Mm-hmm. But what the big challenge is that Guild Wars is not that Guild Wars has an established world to it. It's got a very good foundation to build off of, but it continues to be a dynamic, growing world. And we keep adding things to it, and we keep developing, and we keep coming up with ideas. I always refer to our company as being creatively fearless. If we come up with a good idea, we'll go do that, even if it means going back and changing some things. The day we made Turnover for this novel, a really cool dome showed up in Divinity's Reach. And so, when we were in revisions for that, we said, okay, we gotta add that. We gotta put in a line for that because that just showed up like the day we were sending it out. Also, a big difference working on MMOs as opposed to even large scale RPG and book projects like the Forgotten Realms is the huge number of talented individuals. And in this case, writing this book was very much a public act. We, posted, the chapters in our files. And I'd have people I'd be working on, people would come over and have questions or ask, tell me they liked a particular line, etc. And they're reading along as we're writing it. So everyone is involved and everyone's engaged.
That's one of those things that just keeps you, you know, it keeps you in there. It keeps you in the game, certainly. I mean, the lore of Guild Wars has been something that a lot of gamers talk about all the time. So it's always exciting, and it's definitely exciting to be able to talk to you today. I'm so thankful that you came on the show and that we were able to do this interview. If anyone wants to check out the book, it's coming out on July 27th. Is that right?
Yes.
And it's Ghosts of Ascalon. You can check out GuildWars2.com. They'll have some information on their main page, I'm sure, when the book releases. But again, thanks, Jeff, for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.